Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Uncensored CMO. Now, in this episode, we're going to be talking about more boom and less bust with the wonderful Scott Morrison, the inspirational, energizing coach that teaches marketing teams how to do it, how to be more successful, how to turn around business, how to win pitches. This is a great, energizing, inspirational masterclass in how to create more boom and less bust. Scott Morrison, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John. Great to be here. I've been looking forward to this for a little while.
I do love, you know, your title of your company, because I internally in my day job assistant one, whenever we have a result, I always send around a massive boom.
There you go.
And it's become like trademark. So I'm just like, you know, it's great we're having this conversation. Where did the name come from?
Well, exactly that reason. When I was at Diesel, exact same thing. Whenever something brilliant happened, the team always used to just go boom. And actually, it's been quite useful for me, because when I'm speaking to people and just having a chat, and people say, well, what do you do and everything else? I say, listen, let me ask you a question. When something goes really well and everything's going how you want it to be and your business is firing, what's the one word that comes into your mind? And they go, well, boom. Yeah. I go, yeah, great. Let's get to that.
There it is.
And then so it kind of is quite a neat little sales pitch, because it's an emotional connection. One of the first things you always think about when you're building a brand is, I could have called it Scott Morrison Consulting, but that's really boring and nobody would have come to work with you. But you call it something emotionally engaging. And boom, people connect with it. Boom.
There you go. Brilliant. Now, you've had a really cool career. You've worked in some iconic, on some iconic brands and in some iconic agencies. Take us back to the beginning, because interestingly, the very first application I ever wrote at university was to Saatchi & Saatchi.
Oh, wow.
And the application form was fascinating. So I went down the library, as you did back then. Didn't have internet. Yeah. Went down the library to dig out all the application forms. And I just thought advertising sounded pretty cool. Yeah. And so I found Saatchi & Saatchi as the most famous agency I could think of. And it was a really thick application form. It was 30 pages.
Like, wow.
Oh my God, this is amazing. And it opened it up, blank pages. I thought, that's clever.
Yeah, genius.
That is clever. Like, what do you want to tell us? How much do you use? What's important? I'm like, that's really good, isn't it? Anyway, I didn't get the job, but you did. So you started off at Saatchi & Saatchi.
Yeah, well, my application form, weirdly, it was very thick as well, but it was a cardboard colouring in book. And each of the pages had a story that you had to create and colour in and tell the story about.
Ah.
Again, you know, just crazy. You look at it and go, how everyone else, you know, all loads of questions. You know, Saatchi was very different. And I fell in love with that whole approach, because it was just like, well, what are you going to do? How do you do it? What's good? What's not? It really made you think differently. And interestingly, I got to the sort of second round, and they take you, you know, you're a student at the time, they take you to a really plush restaurant, they look after you for a weekend, but they put you through kind of an intense SAS training thing. So on the first night, they took us to a really beautiful restaurant, and we're all sat having dinner, and I was sat next to Marilyn Baxter, who was then the CSO of the business. I didn't realize who she was at the time. Very, very senior. And, you know, you're going through dinner, you've had a couple of drinks, chatting away, and all of a sudden, five people came down the stairs into the restaurant and sort of looking for a table. And I said to Marilyn, who are these people? And she said, oh, these people applied for several second round interviews, and we allowed them to come to the Saatchi second day because, you know, they had all these other interviews. And I can't do it here, but I literally slammed my hands on the table and she went, that is disgraceful. I said, I can't believe that I'm here because Saatchi is the only place I want to work. It's the only place I've ever wanted to work. And I can't believe you've... And I sort of had this kind of rant and then suddenly zipped my mouth and went, oh no, I've just blown it here. And then got the job. And then when I bumped into Marilyn not long after, she said, that conversation you had with me at the dinner table showed how passionate you were about the business and the brand. And I thought at that moment in time, we've got to hire
him.
Oh, so these little serendipitous moments where you sort of think, have I said the right thing or the wrong thing? But, you know, if you're passionate, I was just so passionate about wanting to get into that industry and get into that specific agency.
Well, in any interview, you're looking for passion, aren't you? Passion,
absolutely.
Passion is a big percentage of why you hire someone. Do you care? Do you want to be here? You know?
Yeah. And are they going to fit into the culture of this organization? And the beautiful culture at Saatchi's, and it still is nothing is impossible. And literally like the blank piece of paper, it just opens up a whole world for you. Like when you're thinking about solutions, when you're thinking about creative work, when you're thinking about commercial work, when you think about anything, the starting point is like there's nothing we can't do, as long as it's, you know, legal and whatever else. But there really was nothing that you couldn't do. And if you came up with something as long as it was creating value and making something good for the client, people would say, yeah, we'll help you do that. And that was just fascinating. And you can't have that unless you've got that fire in people to make that want to happen.
And I think there's an iconic Adidas strapline, isn't there, that inverts that?
Yeah, that's right.
Impossible is nothing. Impossible is nothing, isn't
it? Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Which seamlessly brings us to your next role, doesn't it? Because you went from there to Wieden and Kennedy to work on the Nike account.
That's right, yeah.
Which is pretty cool. I mean, Nike's iconic, isn't it? I mean, so many people have, you know, revere Nike for what they've done. What's your experience having worked with them about what is it about Nike that just makes people so passionate about wanting to work there? I know, you know, people even have tattoos, for example, don't know, right, when they work there or something. What is, can you explain what that is and how that's made their business what it is today?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely one of the things that I focus on in my current business, because it is one of the most important things. And it's all about culture. Like, it is about the impact that a culture can create on people, and then in turn on the creativity, and in turn, of course, on the business. And those three words, just do it, are absolutely embedded, just like nothing is impossible, in the Saatchi world, in the Nike world. And how that translated to the work that we were doing is, you know, there was a real kind of like, you know, don't give me any bullshit. You swear? Can we swear?
This is uncensored, yeah.
Oh, right, cool. Yeah. Okay, I'll do that.
We've had Mark Ritson on, so don't worry. We're all clear on that front.
So yeah, what it boiled down to is like, don't give me any bullshit. You know, let's go and try these things over here. If we want to create another sport, let's just go and make it happen. You know, when I did we worked on the World Cup, I can't remember what year it was now, but the World Cup work. And, you know, most of the World Cup work people are doing is all about, you know, just football and everything else. No, not at Nike. It was like, we're going to create a new sort of football called Scorpion football. And then, this is pre-social media, we're going to divide London up into 16 different sections, each which will be a Scorpion team. And they will all compete against each other, and then we'll bring them all to the O2 to create this huge football kickoff at the end of the World Cup. So that sort of stuff was just like, you know, at that time, without the kind of ease of stuff that you've got now, people would have been like, oh, we can't possibly do that. But everyone from, you know, the client to the agencies, the people we work with, to the business itself, to the actual people who got involved on the street in London, you know, that's what they just associate with that brand. It's like, let's just go and make things happen. Let's just go and do it. And I think that pervades through the work, pervades through the product, pervades just through the attitude. And I think you can sort of see Nike people, you know, when you meet Nike people, you meet them. And I think it was a great marriage for Wieden's, because that was how Wieden's was at the time, you know, and still is now. Let's just go.
Iconic
and make
relationship,
great stuff.
Isn't it? Wieden's and Nike together, very similar, yeah.
And that cultural match and that cultural pairing is I think, what helps drive both those businesses.
And a real founder legacy as well, isn't it? I mean, I read Shoe Dog and all the stories, you know, in terms of how Nike challenged the way marketing is done, and also that they have Just Do It as a philosophy that's carried through in everything. Thing and just, you know, you can see it everywhere, can't you? It's very impressive.
Well, I think when you've got, you know, if you look, they created that little manifesto at the very beginning, you know, Phil Knight, and those first principles really hold true. And I think, you know, for any business, you know, your first principles, the things that really drive your organization, if you hold true to those throughout everything that you do, it goes to show that, you know, fundamentally, you know, you maintain that culture, you maintain that momentum, and you keep the brand healthy and where it needs to be. And the minute you kind of deviate from that, and by the way, brands do deviate from that, things can go very wrong. So it's always about keeping your eye on that, and how do you stay true to that rather than moving too far away from it.
It's a good exercise, isn't it? Like, what are we here to do, and what are our guiding principles that will never, ever change, and just try and document the way that, because you're right, actually. I mean, it gets shared, doesn't it, regularly on LinkedIn or whatever, the original thing you wrote
up with seven or eight
principles or whatever. Yeah. You read them and you go, might be 40, 50 years old now, but it's like, bang on.
Well, I mean, I often say to business I work with, like, what's your equivalent?
Yeah.
You know, what's your, I hate the word manifesto, but, you know, what is the thing that guides this organization? And when you can start to tell stories, that's the key thing. Another thing, stories that embellish that, you know, that tell the story about how this business came about, or some moments in a meeting, or pivotal decisions that made this shoe great, or that campaign great, or that athlete sign, or whatever else. Those are things that perpetually, because they become mythology, right? Great brands have a mythology about them. Sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. But if you can dig into those stories, it gives the next generation, the people in the business, something to reflect on, something to sort of bounce and use as part of their everyday. And if you don't have that, that's a real challenge.
Mm. And it's great for recruitment as well, isn't it? Because I think part of the reason why Nike hires so many great people is that they're steeped in the legacy and the history of Nike. So when they join, they kind of almost know already what the culture is, don't
they? Yeah, exactly.
Which I think is brilliant.
Exactly.
One thing I want to ask you, you know, I the energy, and I love the boom, and you know, we've done a few things together, and you know, it's so much fun. But let's just briefly, before we talk about more about how to create the boom, what happens when things go bust? Right. So occasionally they do. And one of the things I love about you is your kind of honesty and facing into things. So tell me a time in your career maybe where things haven't gone quite so well.
It's great that we've just covered sort of the Nike Wieden thing, because I was in advertising for quite a long time. Then I moved into brands. And part of the reason I did that is because when I left Saatchi's to go to Wieden's, I was given a kind of a brief to go in. And part of the brief was, you know, we want to get the account management a bit tighter. We want to, you know, we want to get a bit more professional. Still quite a young sort of startup in the UK at that time. It was more, you know, a satellite of the Amsterdam office. And so I went into Wieden's with that in the back of my head going, right, I'm going to be Mr. Saatchi, you know, get all this stuff, you know. And it's a great example to me of how culture can reject, you know, something, an alien thing, you know. So yeah. I came in and I didn't handle it particularly well. I was like, no, you need to change that. Now, why is that not happening? I got very frustrated and very annoyed. And the organization was like, who's this guy? Like, we're not Saatchi's. The culture's different. He's got to try and adapt to this culture, not we're going to just suddenly, you know. So it became for me a very frustrating 18 months. And in the end, I left the business. I left the business and ended up going to be client side. But it was, for me, it was an enormous failure, because you know, you don't get the opportunity to work on that piece of business and in an iconic agency like that very often. You know, they're kind of dream roles for people.
Yeah.
And I sort of beat myself up quite a while going, I didn't make the most of it. But with everything, you learn, right? I learned that, you know, when you want to make culture shift, you've got to do it in a different way. You've got to bring people with you. You can't just try and change everything straight away. And actually, you've always got to think, what's the real brief? What really needs to happen here? And how do I really understand that before I just sort of jump in and try and make
it? It's a good point, because it's easy to look at the name above the door, isn't it? Go, oh, I want to work there. But understanding how the culture works, how decisions get made, how things operate, all those kind of things, you need to kind of discover that before you join, really, or have that as part of your interview process.
It's one of those funny things. We were just saying earlier, weren't we? You know, buying a house, we spend less time buying a house than we do buying a pair of jeans. And I sometimes think in an interview process, you spend a lot less time sort of questioning the culture that you're going into than you would, you know, going out, you know, going on a first date on Tinder or something. I don't know. Yeah. And so when you walk into an organization, sometimes you're so ill-equipped, you know, what you've been asked to do and what the job description says or whatever else you go in with is actually quite far removed from actually what's going on in the organization. And you don't always have the chance to, you know, you don't get a test drive very often.
And success is often so much down to not just technical competence, but the ability to get things done, work with other people, get things approved, adapt to what the business needs you to do, all those kind of things. So it's all those softer things that we don't spend any time thinking about before we join an
always organization. No one's sitting there waiting for their new manager, you know, oh great, I can't wait for my new manager or new director to join. You know, no one's sitting there waiting for that, because people and, you know, humans, we naturally want the status quo. We quite like it. Thank you very much. So they know that when someone new's coming in, it's going to bring its own challenges. They're not sitting there waiting. So if you just go in and actually just don't confront that in the right way, you're just adding it. You're just adding fuel to the fire. And then the body rejects the organ.
It gets
or whatever
rejected,
they say.
Yeah, yeah, that's so true. Yeah. Now, you mentioned jeans, because that takes us nicely in, doesn't it, to your next venture, which was at Diesel.
Diesel's
one of my favorite brands. And, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I'd probably, there'd be my default choice, right? I'd be, you know, £100 pair of Diesel jeans, that kind of, and I love the positioning, only the brave. It's one of the most iconic, I think, challenger brand positionings. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, my perception is they're not necessarily the brand that they were. What's happened to Diesel and, you know, in the last few years?
Well, it's interesting, the kind of timeline, and it's a good reflection for any brand, you know. All brands that come out at some stage, you know, good fashion brands are hot for a moment, right? And the hard thing for brands like that is, how do you maintain the longevity whilst, like we were saying earlier, how do you stay true to your core? And if you move away from your core, then of course bad things can happen. And, you know, I think at Diesel, you'd have probably seen probably 15 years ago when I was there, We had sort of various transitions. So we were very focused on For Successful Living, which was a great story, kind of subverted the world through a different lens and you know, really hot, great product, everything else. Then there was a subtle shift where we tried to become a more premium brand. And what's interesting is, you know, if you're not in the premium world, to suddenly try and move into premium, it's very, very difficult. In fact, it's almost impossible. It doesn't matter how much positioning you do, it isn't, you know, you're just not going to get in there. And I think with respect to the brand, we realized that actually that wasn't going to work. And so we had to go back to what's the core element and essence of the brand. So that's when you might have seen a few years ago, the Be Stupid campaign and all the thinking back around Renzo, the founder and owner of the brand, how he thought, how, you know, being stupid isn't about, you know, being dumb, jackass sort of stupid. It's about we think differently. When the world says you can't do things, actually you can. And marries up nicely with kind of just do it and nothing's impossible. So that's why it's important. But once you go back to those kind of first principles, then that helps the brand, help the brand push on again. So the retail, the product, everything going back to this is the heartland of this brand and what this business stands for. But again, and I think like all, you know, fashion, I was looking yesterday at what people were saying about Superdry. If you looked at in the news, somebody said they're not cool anymore. That's why they're struggling. You know, you have challenges, you've got distribution, you know, you've got things called adjacencies. You have to be seen with the right brands. And that isn't just a localized thing. That's a global thing now, much more. So if you're in one market, in one set of adjacency positions, and another market is in a very different one, much more premium, it looks different. And the travelers from that market come into the UK and they don't see the brand in where it needs to be, then of course that shifts their perception back in the market.
Yeah.
So you've always got to be thinking, like any great portfolio leadership, you've got to be thinking, where do we need to, how do we maintain everything? How do we maintain pricing, cause all sorts of things. And I think that the brave decisions, literally only the brave, are, you know, the business has had another great turn because it's looked at, well, what's the right size for this business? Where do we really need to be? What are our adjacencies? What does the brand look like? What does a product look like? What's the, you know, how do we maintain that diesel spirit? And I look around now and it's quite nice because, you know, I now see and hear the younger generation coming up to me. You know, if I go to do marketing stuff, people say, oh, you used to work at Diesel. Yeah, it's really cool again now. But you have all these kind of cycles. You know, 1 minute it's in, 1 minute it's not, 1 minute it's in. And you kind of got to live, whenever you live with a fashion brand like that, you've got to live with that.
Yeah.
But it's how you, it's all about how you recognize when you're in a position that's not where you want to be and why, and then what do you need to do about it? Because it's very easy to the ego kicks in. No, we're going to keep going. Before you know it, no one's buying the brand, the wrong people are wearing it, and the brand is dead. But you've got to go, no, we've got to make some significant changes. Yeah. We've got to cut back on distribution. We've got to focus on retail. We've got to get back to the product looking like this. We've got, you know, whatever it is that it might look like, you've got to make those tough calls in the long term for the health of the brand.
We don't talk enough about this, actually, because we tend to talk about what makes success, right? But a lot of people are working on brands that are facing decline. They've got competition. I mean, a few points in my career, I've worked on drinks brands that have been in quite rapid decline, or where the category's shrinking, or where it's been relaunched a couple of times and it's failed.
Yeah.
And it's hard, right? It's hard because it takes a while to do that turnaround, you know, to get back to what is it you're here to do, to try and make the long-term changes that you talked about. You know, it can take time. And it's really hard, you know, when you've got a business that's like, you know, wants growth immediately, you know, because you can don't go to short-term discounting to try and like, you know, push up the sales. It'd be the worst thing to do, you know what I mean? So it's really hard, isn't it? So any advice to anyone like right now facing, maybe they got a lot of competition, brands in decline, what do they do to, you know, help turn it around?
Yeah, well, this is what I do with the business that I work with, actually. I mean, I somehow I've been labeled a turnaround kind of expert in a way. I've helped turn around lots of businesses and lots of brands. But I use a very simple, really simple, I try and make everything as simple as I can when I'm doing business, but just a really simple process that goes on in my mind and that works to try and help people think differently about the business. Because when you're in that kind of lull, or, you know, it's very easy to make those, like you say, short-term decisions, not think long-term, panic, you know, do lots of stuff rather than do the things that really matter. So the simple three words that I use are unblock, unlock, unleash. In the first instance, we think about unblocking success. So what does success look like? What do we want to get to? What does it look like? So I have an exercise that I do with boards around the world. It's quite funny, which is they've got to create a movie poster. And it's fascinating because at first they go, I'm not doing that. And then within an hour of doing it, they're like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then it becomes this kind of totem for the business. But once you understand that, then you've got to think about, well, what's blocking? What do we need to unblock to get there? Because once you've got that very different perspective on what the turnaround looks like or what growth looks like, you can then go, well, what's stopping us? And then that's where you start to have the really meaty discussions about what's the friction, what's getting in the way. Once you start to bring those out, then you can start to unlock new ways forward, new thinking, new ideas, outside-in expertise. Quite often, by the way, a lot of the unlocking is most of the people in the room know what needs to happen.
So true.
They've never had the space to have the conversation because if you say, well, actually, that thing over there, we need to do that because of this. But no, that's not true. But once you brought the blockers out and they're on the table, people go, oh, actually, yeah, that is a blocker. Right, so now we can think about that. So once you start unlocking new ways of doing things, the final thing is then unleashing. The challenge with turnarounds and things like that is if you've got to go through 55 different approval processes to get anything happening, or people just sit around chin stroking and go, yeah, this might be a nice idea. By the time you've done that, you've lost another, I don't know, 100 million, or you've lost another outlet or whatever else. So you've just got to create, you've got to create actions that start to happen and roll out in the marketplace that you are in. Whether that is, you know, in turnarounds, you do things like contract negotiations, you know, really boring stuff, or supply chain challenges. You look at all these things. They're the things that people don't want to touch because it's like, oh, that's going to take too long. But as soon as you start getting a bit of traction in each area, you start to see where the heat is, you start to see things moving and changing, and then you can kind of double down on that if you need to, or you can, you know, make tweaks along the way. You can say that's not really important, that is. So it's really about finding where are the key levers? How do we get blockers out of the way? How do we create new ideas, join dots in new and interesting ways, and get people engaged? Back to the point we said earlier.
Yeah.
People often know the answer in your organization.
Yeah.
If you get them engaged and power them up with their thinking, they will make it happen for you. And get them out in the marketplace doing the work, getting the action happening.
Execution's so key, isn't it?
It's the only thing that makes the change happen. Because, you know, we're geared to spend a lot of time thinking, and thinking makes us feel good. There's a great quote by a guy called Daryl Davis. He says, we live in space age times with stone age minds. And it's this thing of, you know, we've got all this kind of incredible technology, ability to do things, but our brain sometimes just goes back into the old ways of thinking. And it's like, I'm just going to sort of sit and think about this, or, you know, I'm in flight and fight and I can't, you know, there's nothing I can do, all that sort of stuff. And you've got to really get your mind into the right position to go, right, if we're going to make change, these are the things we need to do. And then you've got to get doing them, and you've got to make it happen.
Yeah.
And the more you create action, the more momentum you get. And it doesn't matter whether it's good momentum or bad momentum, because you can then make course corrections. But if you've got no momentum, you've got nothing.
Absolutely. The curious thing I learned, I've been in this situation a few times, and probably the most challenging one is I did a management buy-in to a juice brand. And I had like something like 12 or 14 weeks to completely change everything. So it was a new factory line, it was new flavors, it was new labels, it was everything, new customer. I mean, literally we were just pivoting from one market to another.
Wow.
In what was probably about a quarter of the time that a big company would do it. Yeah. Now we were small, privately owned. It was possible to move that quickly, just sort of thing. But we relaunched in the summer, and it was a really hot summer, and we had a mold infestation on the production line, right? And of course, you know, imagine juice with bits of mold in. It's like, God, it's not a great start, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we had to recall the products from the market totally. And we just got all these new customers signed up, and they were screaming at us going, we've just put you into every store, and we've just got all these complaints. The complaints were going wild. So imagine all the photos we were getting and the upset customers and the people that were being, you can imagine this sort of thing, right? Yeah. And so what we then did is we had to do a big investigation into what's gone wrong and what we're going to do and how we're going to relaunch. The thing I learned, it was really powerful actually, was that the thing I thought had gone wrong, or the reason for it going wrong, by the time we finished, it took about 6 months to a proper, you know, root and branch review and analysis. The assumptions I made at the beginning were completely wrong. Yeah. And we ended up, I think it was something like 95, you know, discoveries we made in this process of figuring it all out. But it was a real lesson in sometimes you have to go a little bit slower and properly understand how this is made, you know, what, you know, and actually properly make the improvements. And then, so we lost about 6 months. When we relaunched, oh my word, it just literally took off. Yeah. I mean, we became the fastest growing drink in the country, and it just absolutely exploded. It was brilliant, right? But it took that pain. Yeah. In a weird way, I think we ended up being more successful over 3 years, almost because of the pain of having to literally like understand it and how does it work and, you know, all this kind of thing. It was a weird thing. But I remember the lesson, which is a bit of an odd lesson, is you've got to You've got to properly give yourself the right time to do the right things and take a longer term view, because the pressure to go, let's go for the quick fix, let's go for the discount, rather than discount the price to all the customers and all that kind of thing, which is the knee jerk reaction,
of course, and you'll never get that back.
Yeah, you can't recover from that. Do the right thing.
But I mean, it's a great point, because really understanding that, that's why I go in the unblock phase, because it's very easy for people to unlock. If you go and say to people, let's have a brainstorm about these things that we need to do, or go off and go and do some solutions. People can do all that because we're geared to do that as humans. But what we're not doing then is actually understanding what we're solving for. Mm. I was working with a global airline business, right? And it was a completely sort of different thing. But they were saying to me, Scott, we've created all these values and this vision and values for the whole organization, massive organization around the world. Nobody's using them. I was like, okay, what do you think we need to do then? Well, we're going to have to do them all again. Okay. So we did the unblocking session. I run this sort of diagnostic program with them, and we worked through what's actually going on. And what they thought was that the vision and values nobody connected with. And actually, when we started doing the unblocking, what they realized was that they hadn't actually told many people about it. Yeah. It had really gone to the boardroom and a few other people. And when they then started creating some experiments, okay, let's get it out to people. People loved it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting because they could have gone away and gone, right, we're going to redo them all, spend a load of money, redo it all. And, exactly. and that would have been, I don't know, exactly. £1 million, let's say. Or we can just spend £20,000 and properly market it and get people involved. And that's what the mistakes people are making all the time, because they're jumping into, let's quickly do this, quickly do that. So creating action is good when you know
when
what
you know
it is
what
that
is
you're solving.
There's a brilliant story. I think I need to try and find it again, because I've quite quoted this a few times, but I think it's in a Malcolm Gladwell book. And there was a virus that broke out on a campus somewhere, university campus somewhere.
Yeah.
And they wanted to get the students inoculated against this virus to stop it spreading.
Right.
And so at the beginning of every lecture, they put a big picture up showing what would happen if you don't get vaccinated. So they were showing the kind of consequences.
Yeah.
Anyway, no one got vaccinated the next day, and they're like, what do we do? So they thought, the problem is the message, right? We've got to amp the message up. So they basically they made it more graphic on the next day to really scare the audience and go like, this is what it could be, really serious. And same thing, nothing happened, right? So they went the third day, they were, what do we do? We're gonna have to go even more graphic and even more extreme on the message. So they really show some even more graphic images of what happens, and still no one went to the doctor. And someone came up with an idea. And the next day they put a map of where the doctor was.
Great.
It wasn't the message.
I thought you were going to say nobody dared leave their rooms because they were too scared to get this horrendous disease.
Yeah. It was simply the problem they were solving for is no one knew where the doctor was.
I think one of the greatest media campaigns ever, because people often say, what's your favourite? What's one of the most best campaigns you've seen? I think it's when McDonald's, when they started putting
arrows around the corner. Yeah.
I don't eat loads of McDonald's. I do occasionally, but that whole thing of where's our audience? They're coming up the tube. Yeah. They probably had a few drinks of a night out, and they want some there's McDonald's.
Turn left down the street.
It's just like, that's what I like. Simple solutions that create action.
Yeah.
Based on, they've obviously know what the need is. They've thought of lots of different things. They haven't got anything fancy. They've just gone, let's do the thing that's the most, that's going to create the most impact.
The real
let's just do it.
Exactly. Yeah. The desire is probably already there. I want to move from turnaround to rapid growth, right? Yeah. So different scenario, different problems kind of bring to it. And you're fortunate I've been in sort of two or three cases of working in rapidly scaling up businesses, which are hugely exciting.
Yeah.
But they bring their own challenges, don't they?
Absolutely.
In terms of how you succeed and maintain momentum. What would be your advice in people in those situations? Situations where you got kind of a success on your hands?
Well, across my business, I call this thing the Holy Trinity, right? And I think if you get the Holy Trinity right in impact, then you really do start to see a difference in organization. And the Holy Trinity is creative impact, cultural impact, and commercial impact. So can you get the culture of your organization right, geared up to create impact and get the people on board? Can you then use creative to drive that, and creative thinking, not just creative output, but creatively thinking across all the department, can your people use that creative superpower as humans to do what they need to do? And then how does that commercially translate? So if you're thinking creatively, then you can bring that into the commercial thinking, join dots in new and interesting ways, create new products, blah, blah, blah. Get that right, you're off. The key thing that drives all of that, and I think it's particularly important in rapid growth organizations, is the idea of the learn fast culture. So quite often, it's quite sexy to say, hey man, and fail fast and all that sort of thing. And I hear it a lot, and I hear it in in corporates, and I hear it in, you know, small parts of corporates, you know, the kind of incubators and all that, because they kind of think it's like San Francisco. It's quite cool to say. The reality is it's not. And actually, businesses that scale and grow really quickly, what they know and what they do, they go, right, you know, we've got to create action and stuff and block and lock and leash, but we're going to create the currency around learning. And if we learn fast, it doesn't, we'll create lots of experiments, we'll do create lots of hypotheses, we'll test loads of things, we'll get the wheel moving. But we're not going to worry whether it's a failure or a success. Because once we start saying to people, oh, you failed, then it, you know, back to Stone Age minds, failure is a really toxic human, you know, thing, right? For most people. Because if you fail, you know, in the world of working, if you fail, I could lose my job. Or if I lose my job, I'll lose my house. If I lose my house, I've lost everything. So people don't want to fail. And of course, they want to succeed. But actually, when you make the shift and go, no, the currency in this organization is about learning. The more learning we do, the faster we learn, that's going to be our competitive advantage. That will help you get to rapid growth, because you suddenly go through a process and block and lock and leash, create the right actions. Now let's get them moving quickly. Focus on the right things. Focus on the things that are going to grow the business and just get the learnings, feed them in. And those businesses that don't do that, they don't create that learn fast culture. You know, you kind of get fiefdoms, you kind of get success in silos. You get people, you know, you don't get a team operating on the same levels. You get sort of somebody over here, I'm really successful, this person, you get kind of cross departmental rivalries, and it's just becomes quite toxic. So So for me, the kind of fundamental thing always is about culturally, how do you set the right tone in the culture to make people really believe that they can do something different, whether that's indeed turnaround, or more important in this case, rapid growth.
You're absolutely right about the toxicity of failure, aren't you? And again, there's another story that I wish I remembered where I heard it. Kind of thing. I need somebody needs to invent an app that just records stuff.
Yeah, because stories.
Oh, you remember that time, you know. But I think it was in the car industry. I don't know. I think it was in the car industry. And this exec had made a monumental mistake, and it cost the business £20 million. And he went to the CEO and handed in his resignation. And the CEO's reply was, I didn't just spend £20 million on your education not to use it.
Yeah, very true.
I was like, wow, that's amazing, isn't it? Like, you know, but it's true. So, but back to your learning is taking, you know, because we will fail. I mean, you know, the only people that won't fail are people that haven't tried anything. But, you know, it's going to happen, right? So use it to learn, you know, and put it to your advantage.
I often tell the story of Mike Asperhoff, I think it was a USS Benfleet in the US Navy, right? And they'd spent $1 billion on this ship, and it was the worst performing ship in the whole US Navy. And he was brought in to head up the ship. And of course, they needed rapid growth because they'd invested all this money. They needed to literally, you know, get that ship working correctly. Now, there's a number of ways you can kind of go and do that, right? But his way was, I'm just going to do three things. I'm going to walk in, I'm going to go to everybody in the organization on the ship, and I'm going to say, hi, my name is Mike. I'm the new leader. What's your name? What do you do on the ship? And how could we make it better? So, you know, my name's Doreen. I put the nuts on the hull. And if I was to make it better, I wouldn't buy steel nuts because they cost four times as much as rubber nuts and they last three times less. Yeah. So let's just buy rubber nuts. Okay, go and make that happen. Went around the ship, got everybody to do it. Had a huge amount of experiments happening. That ship then within 3 years became the top gun of the US Navy. Now, of course, it's a bit of a turnaround story, but also if you think about the level of investment, then it's kind of it's also a rapid growth of people story.
Yeah.
Because the people were suddenly powered up to go, well, I have got a say here. I can make a decision. I can help the ship learn fast. And with everybody learning fast, they just got this incredible growth.
Yeah.
And you know what that does? It creates more leaders in an organization. You know, think about, you know, what do you need to maintain that? What you need is not to just be one fulcrum person in the whole organization. You need great leaders, create leaders. They always say, right? Yeah. You need other leaders in the organization to take things forward, to take the decisions, to find other blockers, to keep things moving forward. When everybody's doing that, that's when you start to see that growth.
It's a really good point in there about scaling, isn't it? Because you can't scale unless you're delegating to other people who know best than you because they're closest to the answer and empowering them to make the decision.
It's so true.
And there's a thing we've used at System One, actually, and we borrowed and stolen from Amazon, the whole idea of the flywheel, which is like breaking down where growth comes from and how it happens, and almost breaking the stages down to go, well, if this happens, then that happens, and that happens, and then you get growth. And then looking at it and go, well, where do we not have enough resource? Where are we getting blocks? Where do we need to do things faster? Where do we need to put resource? Yeah. And it's a really simple concept. But what I like about it is it's it connects the organization in a way that I think before we might have thought in silos. And of course, when you think just in your own silo, you can say, well, I think I should do this better. But, you know, you get passed the ball from this department and pass it on to that department, and thinking about how all those things connect together. And like your general going around to everyone going, well, that connects to that, connects to that. And that's how the ship goes faster.
Oh, I tell you, joining the dots is one of the, join the dots in new and interesting ways, I always call it. But it's one of the most underused business tools that you can have. And it sounds a little bit trite, but I was doing some work a couple of years ago now, with a footwear brand, global footwear brand, and very similar, right? Had huge growth, trying to understand where the pockets of growth were, but didn't really know. And so we had the whole of the global organization together for 3 days. And to help them understand where it was coming from and then actually how to make more of it, how to kind of scale it, we created a very simple approach. And the simple approach was, if you hear an idea that you like, that's going to grow, that's been growing the business, then adopt it. If it's right, but not quite right for your market, you need to do some tweaks, adapt it. But only then, if you've neither of those two things, can you invent something. So what was happening lots of people, our human nature, right? We understand the blocker. Yeah. We want to create a solution. Six markets create the same solution, same level of investment, sunk cost, you know, return in a small market. So they're getting growth. But actually, wouldn't it be better if one market was doing it and then all those learn fast results were being fed across the organization? Yeah. And it's the antithesis to how we normally work, right?
Yeah.
Because you speak to a lot of people and the first thing you want to do is invent the solution.
Yeah.
You reverse that, you reframe it for everybody. And so what happened was the big growth projects, the big growth stuff that was going on, people were, I want to adopt that myself. Thank you very much. So it created this, broke the barriers down, broke the silos down, got people working together, but created a much lower cost base because you were just investing one time and getting the return from that one thing rather than doing six or seven. And then actually it meant other people had space to then think about, well, what else can we do?
Yeah.
And so it became this beautiful, virtuous cycle. Yeah. But that's how you got to think if you want to create rapid growth. Don't duplicate the stuff that's going on.
It's quite a weird pivot, but in a weird sense, that's kind of partly why I wanted to do this podcast, because there is not a problem that anyone listening right now is facing that someone else hasn't faced somewhere else, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I was thinking, if I can disseminate and talk about the failures and the successes, and there will be someone out there listening that's gone, that's exactly what I'm facing now. That's but when so you're true. In it, you think you're the only person in the world that's ever come up against this particular problem,
And it's also... We're often told at school and everything else, oh, you can't, no, don't copy ideas. Don't copy from somebody. Yeah, put your ruler up so they can't see work. But actually, Grace and Perry, we wrote the book, Creative Superpowers.
Oh, yeah.
I think 3 or 4 years ago now. Mark, Laura, Danny Elliott and I, we put together this book. There were four key skills in there: hacker, maker, teacher, thief. The four superpowers for as humans that if we really leverage, it will bring real power back to sort of creative impact. And Mark's whole element was about copying, stealing, the thief element. And I always draw upon that because it is one of those things as a leader in an organization, it can be lonely at the top. You know, you're CMO, you're at the top of the business. And sometimes, like, I remember my MD always saying to me, Scott, I don't understand marketing. It's down to you.
Yeah.
And so you're like, oh. And you get these challenges and then you sort of think, oh my God, I've got to invent something. And actually, when you start going, no, where can I steal from? In the nicest possible way. Who's done this before? Who solved it elegantly? And look outside of your realm, I do this a lot with the clients I work with. And suddenly they're bringing in solutions from all sorts of different places that they never thought of, in fields that are so far removed from their own. They're like, why can't we? We've got the same resource. We can do that, And suddenly that generates a whole wealth of new thinking and movement in the organization.
I think, look, you're so right about looking out and looking back as well. Yeah. I think sometimes we had this thing on Lucozade where we had to relaunch it. It was a really pressure cooker situation. And we had a new formulation and someone went back through literally the archives into the history and found the original recipe from the original chemist and looked at the mixture of glucose that was in there and the particular amount of dose that was used to, because it was originally invented to help kids recover from surgery.
Oh, right.
Because this basically physician discovered that children weren't dying because of surgery, they were dying because they couldn't recover from the surgery. And that was the problem, right? So Lucozade was invented.
Good on blocking.
Yes, exactly. There you go, right? To give enough glucose, the body could basically give itself the energy to go through the recovery process.
Right.
But there was a specific amount of glucose required beyond which too much was not as effective, right? Mm-hmm. So there was actually a perfect amount. Anyway, when we're going through this like reformulation, we rediscovered the correct amount that, of course, over years it had changed.
And yeah,
we kind of went back and went, oh, that's, you know, that we were inspired then to go, well, what is the perfect amount that you need to get recovery that's not going to give you too much, that's going to make you overweight, all that kind of stuff, sort of thing. But we just, the story of able to go back to the original invention, it was just like, oh, it was, the answer was there 85 years ago in some library. You know what I mean?
That's the thing is that, as I said, invariably the answer already sits somewhere in the organization or somewhere right next to you or in a field that's so far away that you've not actually thought about it.
Yeah.
And you've just got to really understand, what are we trying to unblock here? Okay, now if we unlock, what's the thinking that we can really unlock and think broad and think wide and then create that action, that will get you really far.
Now, I want to switch gears a little bit to pitching, right? Because you and I love pitching, and you know, we've done a few pitches and we help other people pitch and all that sort of thing. So, and it's one of those things that a lot of people ask me about is, I mean, so I had a 6 month kind of freelance career. It's very short lived. But in those 6 months, there's only one question I got asked time and time and time again. It's like, hey, John, you're a former CMO. How do you pitch to someone like you? Come and tell us how it's done, sort of thing. And I know you do a lot of the same kind of thing. Yeah. What advice would you give to people pitching? And we should remember as well, like the default position on this is, of course, it's agency pitching to client. But the thing I remind everybody is everyone is pitching all the time.
Absolutely.
Whether it's pitching for a job, pitching for an internal promotion, pitching for a move, all the rest of it. So we should think broadly about pitching. But, you know, what would your advice be to someone approaching a pitch?
Well, it's great. I run a, we said, didn't we? I run something called Pitch Boom, actually, which is a process that I use with, and we probably won about $1.5 billion worth of business as a result of doing it. The key thing is
just drop it in.
I got a job then. But seriously, the key thing is you, like we've been talking about throughout this whole podcast, which I really loved, is this idea of reframing and rethinking things. If we just walk into a pitch situation and we do exactly the same pitch that we've done time and time again, because that's what the market does and that's what we see, we'll fail, right? The key thing is that clients really don't give a shit about, you know, they care about the agency and everything else, but they don't want to know who the team is around the table. They don't want to know all your awards and everything. They don't want all this stuff out of context. What you have to remember is that going into that, I always say that agencies and people in service, we're in the business of promotion. You're in the business of promoting actually the person at the other side of the table. They've got to be the hero.
Yeah.
You've got to make them the absolute hero of the story. And so when you think about it that way, you shift from what's the pitch template supposed to be to what's story crap? How would Hollywood do this? I always talk about starting in the scene, like getting the client. Yeah, you know what happens if client, you do about 10 slides and you say, and then there's a slide that comes as your brief to us. And then it's just like the bit of the brief. And that's like the most boring thing ever. Whereas if you, there's that old story, you know, the old pitching, the British Rail pitch you probably heard about, you know, where they just pretend the client walked in and it was a disgusting room, and then they said, this is how your customers feel, and then they went, oh my god, and then they won the pitch. So that's what I say to people, what's the thing, how do you start in scenes so that client goes, oh my god, these people really understand our problem, they really understand our puzzle, they, you know, they've really unblocked it for us, not a little pithy slide and thing. Start in the scene and then make them create the pitch, the theater around the pitch, as them being the hero or heroine of the story. And that all you're playing is a supporting role, but take them through a kind of classic, you know, the ups and downs, help them understand, you know, here's the promised land, here's where we want to get you to, but oh my God, there are blockers. There are things that are going to get in the way. And they're like, oh God, but don't worry, we're going to help you do it. Now let's show you how we're going to do that. And then systematically help them unblock all the things that are going on for them. Don't look at it as if, you know, you putting up awards or putting up a case study is oh right, okay, great, because invariably that case study, they go, well, we don't sell toilet roll, or you know, we don't have a brand that's 100 years old. That's not how to build that connection. And it is always, like you say, people buy people. I know it's an old cliche,
but
you have to. I often talk about the chemistry sessions. I've done chemistry sessions in my program where, again, I use that the movie poster thing. Because there's nothing worse than sitting in the chemistry session. Everyone's got a piece of paper and they're going, right, so let's understand it. And you've kind of got this mock interview situation for an hour where nobody really gets any questions answered how they want it. And everyone doesn't really create any chemistry. Yeah. Actually, physically do something together. Create what the future looks like together. And if you start to do that, and you know, when you come to present stuff, people are like, oh yeah, that's what we want. That's what we said. Yeah, exactly. So you've got to think, you know, and by the way, like you say, this isn't just agency client pitches. You're pitching a new a position for yourself in the business.
Totally.
Start saying to, look at this. You know, this is an absolute disaster. I might be able to step in and, you know, here's what I could do. You know, all this stuff is really useful. Yeah. Stop thinking about pitches as pitches and start thinking of them almost like a Hollywood movie. Yeah. How can you tell that beautiful story? Put yourself in there, but put the other person as the hero.
So it's funny you're talking about promotion, actually, because it actually happened to me. I was in Ireland with a very, very important retailer.
Right.
And the person that literally made all the decisions in that retailer.
Yeah.
And we're up very late in the bar, and he was getting a very early train, a very early plane the next day sort of thing. And I can't remember how many beers in, but anyway, we're right at the bar. I was trying to sort of get out of him. Oh, you know what? You know, how can I kind of win this and da 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 something? And he just turned around to me as clear as day and just said, "How are you going to get me promoted?"
Exactly.
And do you know what? I said to him, I won't say who he's called. I said, "Thank you," because actually, do you know what? You've cut through brilliantly, and it unlocked something, because I suddenly went back and went, "What are they trying to do as a retailer? And how can this individual be credited with the solution to what they're trying to do?" So I went back to him. I said, "Well, look, we're about to launch all this range of low sugar drinks. We're going to reformulate. We're going to remove the biggest amount of sugar anyone's ever removed before from a range of drinks to help the nation tackle obesity. I'm going to give it to you as an exclusive." Right, you know what I mean? And it was just like, I've never heard someone be quite that honest. But I was like, do you know what? Yeah, you're right. So, and one of the things in the kind of pitch training I did, one of the principles that I remember teaching is, every one of your customers has a customer.
Yes.
We kind of think of the customer in this sort of like exalted position of like godlike kind of status, but they've got to go back and sell whatever you're selling to them into the organization.
Exactly.
Often with some people that don't think like, you know, CMO and agency are much more likely to agree on something.
Yeah.
CMO has to go in and go, "Oh, dear CFO, well, I'm going to spend all this money on this crazy idea."
Yeah,
we're going, what are you going to do?
One of the things I always say to people is, what's your Jaws in Space moment? So I don't even know this story, but when they were trying to sell Alien, the film, they went around all the studios, nobody could understand it, and one guy was reading the script and they were trying to sell it again. I think it was the 17th time, and he said, "Oh, I get it, it's just Jaws in Space."
Yeah.
He was like, "Oh yeah," and got it straight away.
There you go.
And then they went round and said, "It's Jaws in Space." Now what you want is your client to be able to go, or the other person to go, what did all those agencies say? And, you know, well, they created this incredible model, all you want is what's the Jaws in Space moment that some the client's going to say about you.
Yeah.
And if that absolutely meets the business objective, puts them as the hero, makes them great, whatever it is, that simple phrase that takes a lot to get to, by the way, because anything's simple, but people don't do the hard work, so they don't get the rewards. If you do the hard work, then all they're going to be going around, if you create a bit of language in the organization that you're pitching, you've won.
That's brilliant.
Before anybody else.
Yeah.
So do that work.
You're helping them sell the idea.
They've just told us that we're going to do Jaws in Space. Oh, I get it. Right, that's it.
The other, and I think it was Richard Warren I was talking to on the podcast, who was selling in, a bit like your customer service point, actually. He was selling an idea into Halifax. And before he sold it to Halifax, he went to one of their branches in the Midlands and met a store manager and pitched the idea to the store manager, and then recorded how emotional and grateful the store manager was about, you know, the way they're representing the bank sort
Wonderful.
Of thing, and how proud they felt.
Yeah.
And he didn't sell the idea. He just played the video.
That's it.
I was just like, that's brilliant. It. Because, you know, if you're in head office and you're making, you're also making advertising for your employees.
Absolutely.
Because you want them to feel proud and, you know, put an extra 10% into their customer set, all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And I thought, what a move.
Yeah.
I thought, that's, you know, prove, brilliant. You know, almost prove, if you can prove something works.
Yes.
You know, before the meeting, then
absolutely.
You're home and host.
Get it in front of people and say, look, we don't just take our word for it. Here's what your customers, your staff.
Your customers think.
That's what they think
them
of
look
it.
Good.
Just watch this.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant. Well, I'd love to keep chatting about this because honestly, like, I get so much energy from this conversation. It's brilliant. But we probably should wrap it up. But Scott, thank you so much, mate. It's been really cool talking to you. And
my pleasure.
Looking forward to more booms.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been fantastic as ever.
More boom, less bust.
Yeah. Well, that's the new bit. That's what I'm talking about. That's my the boom mindset. So that's what I'm talking a lot about at the moment. So the boom mindset versus the bust mindset. How do you stay in it? How do you really create impact as a leader?
Amazing. Bring on the boom.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Scott. Have a great
day.
Take care. Bye.
Take care. Thank you very much for listening or watching Uncensored CMO. I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please do hit the subscribe button wherever you get your podcast. If you're watching, hit subscribe there as well. I'd also love to get a review. Reviews make a big difference on other people discovering the show. So please do leave a review wherever you get your podcast. If you want to contact me, you can do. I'm over on X at Uncensored CMO or on LinkedIn, where I'm under my own name, John Evans. Thanks for listening and watching. I'll see you next time.